Good morning. Nice to see you all. So today, as you know, is December 23rd, and we're right in the middle of the holiday season. It's a season of darkness and light in many cultures, and of generosity and giving gifts, sharing time with loved ones, and the birth of enlightened sages in the world. So we had a Rahatsu Sesshin, or Buddha's Enlightenment Sesshin, which I wasn't able to go to, but I know a lot of you were. And that's a Sesshin to mark the birth of an enlightened sage in the world. So no matter what faith tradition we come out of or we're now practicing, we're encouraged to be generous and compassionate at this time. So I read this piece in a Buddhist magazine recently where a woman was talking about this, and she mentioned the Indian master Atisha. She talked about him and how he would ask this question of whoever he ran into in his day-to-day travels. He'd say, "Do you have a kind heart today?" So that's a good question. And it seems especially pertinent right now when we're encouraged to think about how we relate to each other. So imagine asking this of someone who's rushing around. Maybe they're stuck in traffic. They're trying to get to the mall to get their last present. And you say to them, "Do you have a kind heart today?" So maybe this person is you. It was me. How would you respond to that question? So I think that questions like this are really helpful to me. They help to wake me up, bring me back to myself, to the moment, to my intention for how I want to be. It helps me notice if I've closed my heart, you know, in response to another. And it really stands out starkly lately. When I notice that, I feel if I'm short with someone, I feel remorse immediately and come back. I may apologize if I can. I may go right back to my intention, which is to practice kindness and compassion and unconditional friendliness. Not just on the cushion, but in day-to-day life, and sometimes the hardest people to do that with because we're so forgetful with them are the ones that we're closest to, our partners, our children, our best friends. So I'm going to talk today about Dana as the Paramita, the perfection of Dana and what that means. I'm going to say a little bit about energy or virya, but I realized when I was preparing this that there was a lot to say about Dana. There's probably a lot more to say about virya or energy, and a friend of mine who's here today somewhere is giving a talk in the new year on virya. So on Tuesday nights when we start having particular topics on Tuesday nights in January. So the perfections of the paramitas in the Mahayana tradition are the practices of a bodhisattva in training, which are basically all of us who practice and study the Dharma in this Mahayana tradition. And the goal is awakening, which starts with generating the thought of enlightenment, or bodhicitta. And enlightenment for our purposes is characterized by wisdom and compassion equally. So the start, preparatory to developing compassion, full-blown, embodied compassion, is the practice of generosity or dana, and that's why it's first on the list. So, you know, it's said that when generosity or when compassion is fully realized, then generosity automatically arises without effort. But before that, we make the effort, and sometimes we might not feel like it. Sometimes we don't feel it, and that doesn't matter because we just start wherever we are. So starting where we are is noticing the difficulty that we're having in being generosity, hearing about the ideals of generosity. Here at Zen Center and other places, we sometimes see the gap there. So the practice then, the Dharma gate, is noticing that and starting right there. That noticing is a Dharma gate. It's not some lesser place to be. So what are your conditions and limitations around giving, around dana? That's a good reflection. So it feels to me that giving the gift of attention and presence is a lot like our definition of love in this culture. That is love minus the grasping and the clinging and possession. So if we don't have time to spend with our children, we might buy them things, you know, that can occupy their time. And it's very usual, nothing wrong with it. Occasionally, when balanced with time and presence and attention. But it's an example of the opposite of the perfection of giving, according to the Mahayana. Christmas in our culture with Santa Claus bringing gifts to children all over the world. What if the child from this part of the world doesn't have any clue about Santa Claus? If our child talks to them about Santa Claus, how meaningful is that? We consider it a benign myth that helps our children to feel awe and a sense of magic at the holidays. And certainly, I think for really young children, that's true. But there's some downsides to it. There's definitely some downsides to it. There's the problem that parents of limited means have with the pressure to create Santa for their children, bring lots of gifts, and then the stress that causes them, which then leaks out onto the kids. And there's the fact that the world is diverse and that this is a European-American custom, that it's not shared by people all over the world, and the schools are now filled with children from all over the world. They don't know anything about Santa or getting all these gifts, you know, piles of them at a certain time of the year. So, but it can really make a child unpopular with their peers if they tell them the truth about Santa not being real or being a myth. Yeah. It's okay. You can continue to believe. Just close your ears. So I don't know how parents that are Muslim or Jewish handle this in their families with their kids. You know, whether they encourage the kids to let the parents of the children that believe in Santa Claus be the ones to tell them. That would be a wise piece of advice. But I know when my stepdaughter was 4 years old, her birth mother told her that, you know, with the intention of honesty, being honest, that there wasn't any Santa Claus. So Marga proceeded in her preschool to tell all the other kids that there was no Santa Claus and that they believed in a ridiculous myth, and it didn't make her popular. You know, she seemed throughout her childhood to resonate more with adults than with other kids, you know, when she was little. But that didn't help. But the downside to perpetuating the myth to preserve a child's innocence is that pressure on the parents, and also children figure it out, you know, and then they pretend that they still believe because they want to get the goods. And that can't make you feel really good about yourself. I mean, I think I remember that. I remember feeling kind of squirmy about that part of pretending that I believed, you know, so the gifts would keep coming. Anyway, I think that we can talk with our children about how diverse the world is and what different people's beliefs are, and and we can model Donna and giving as more than just giving stuff indiscriminately, you know, volunteering with the family. Pretty good at any time of year, this time, anytime. Good example of caring for the community at large, not just the immediate family. But if a particular child can't do it or doesn't want to do it, you know, it's probably better to just let them be, you know. I remember when Katagiri Roshi decided he was going to give a gift to his son, his oldest son, Yas. And as a high school graduation gift, he gave him the gift of a 7-day sesshin. Yas, he managed it heroically. He courageously, he did it, but he never sat again. I'm sure of it. He never sat again. So our gifts have to be not for us so much, you know, really thoughtful and well-timed and considering the person that we're giving the gift to. So in early Mahayana teaching stories such as the Jataka tales, the examples seem very extreme for Donna, perfection of Donna by today's standards, such as in the tale of the hungry tigress. Have you heard that one? I think Ben talked about that one time in a talk. In the hungry the Jataka tales are stories of the myths about the Buddha's former lives. And in the hungry tigress, the Buddha encounters a starving mother tigress and her children. And he feels so overcome by compassion that he offers his body for them to eat. So that's an example of the, you know, perfection of giving in pre-Buddhist and early Buddhist times. And the ideal that's held up is that giving would be so, generosity would be so great that we would give up our own lives in order to save another. And certainly people do that. People do that. It's more rare. We see the example in our times of Martin Luther King, who in the end times knew he would likely die for his cause, and of Gandhi and others, many others that are not named, that have sacrificed themselves for their cause. But there's also a story about in the Buddha's life about how he took the milk when he was basically starving of ascetic practices before his awakening. He received this the nourishment so that he could go on and sit through the night. And as we all know, then he became awakened and he was able to offer this much greater gift to the world of his awakening and the example and the possibility, the truth, the teaching of the truth of that life contains suffering and that awakening is possible, is even inevitable. So taking care of our needs is essential to enacting the practices towards the bodhisattva path, towards our greater goal that we have, our thought of enlightenment. So many Westerners are privileged to engage in practices to help extend their lives and practices of self-care. And can spend a lot of money on that. But in Zen we propose a balance. So we encourage ourselves to do challenging practices like 7-day sessions. They're very challenging. And they're not spa packages, as you know. It takes a lot of effort to do that practice, to break through the veils of illusion. And Katagiri Roshi and Suzuki Roshi's lives were shorter than ours will be, very likely. I'm already well past the year the age that Katagiri died. And I plan to live much longer. But the two of them were both very clear when asked about, you know, should you be working as hard as you are? Shouldn't you be resting more? They were both clear about how, you know, if they died doing what they were doing, that they'd be happy, you know. Katagiri resonated with the teaching of ceaseless effort by Dogen. And he always talked about just taking one step on this path, the bodhisattva path, life after life, he'd say. And he only stopped when he was really sick, which is, I guess, common in Japan. I've heard this from people who've gone to monasteries in Japan that if you're just mildly fatigued or you have a cold, that's not considered sick. You have to be, like, ready for the hospital before you can get care and not participate in the group practice. So the downside to this, these early stories about ceaseless giving, is when it becomes servility or subservience in the giver. And that doesn't result in freeing oneself or others. The person who's subservient lacks the power and the agency to exert themselves for this greater goal of awakening. The subservient giver lacks freedom, so can't offer their freedom to others. So the overly humble religious personality comes to mind. That may be a form of hiding out, that kind of giving, you know, just ceaseless giving, and not developing one's own courage and efficacy by just doing what's the easy thing, which is ceaseless giving or indiscriminate giving. So in the early Mahayana teachings, giving was supposed to be indiscriminate and or non-discriminating, and not focusing on results. But today we, in the West, we need to take a look at and use discrimination, especially with some of the, here's another story from the Jataka tales. So the Buddha before, in his lifetime, before becoming Shakyamuni Buddha and his awakening, was supposed to be someone named Prince Vesantara. And Prince Vesantara was an heir of the Sanjaya kingdom. He lived in a palace with his wife Maddie and his two children. He was the epitome, of course, of generosity and compassion. He used a magical elephant. I have no idea. They don't go into detail about how this comes about, but this magical elephant that he possesses is used to ensure that the crops are abundant because it can bring rain. the ideal amount of rainfall, apparently, but there's no detail as to how he does it. But it's perfect for agriculture. But he's so generous that when an emissary from another kingdom comes and wants it, he gives it away. So this makes the subjects of the kingdom really fearful and rageful towards Prince Vesantara, and they demand of the king that the prince be banished from the kingdom. So the prince is banished, but also so is his wife and his children. So in a final act of generosity, he gives away all of his clothes before he goes out on the road, according to the story. And while he's out on the road, he meets an elderly couple. They meet an elderly couple who are frail and destitute. So he gives his children as servants to the elderly couple in the story. So he gives them away. So then the gods intervene. The gods intervene because they're worried he's going to give his wife away next. So they come and they ask for his wife, the princess. And he says yes. And they say, they give the wife back to him. And because of the customs of giving at the time, he can no longer give her because she's been given to him as a gift. So this is a terrible story by our standards, right? Because the children and the wife are possessions of this guy, you know, of the Buddha in his former life. And, well, it ends up, they all live happily ever after because the king feels really badly about the children and gets them back. And then he invites the prince and princess back and they live happily ever after. And there's no indication that we know whether the prince learned anything from any of this. But we're supposed to, or people of that time, and this is actually a pre-Buddhist folktale that stayed in the Jataka tales and are still there. And it's held up as this ultimate in generosity. But you can see a lot of things wrong with that story, right? And with his actions, the things that he did, you know, creating more harm than good, I would say. So the point is that discrimination is important, you know, and thinking about the effects and the timing. And of course, nowadays we don't think of our family members as possessions anymore. So later on in Mahayana Buddhism in China and Japan, the teaching of the emptiness of the giver and the receiver of the gift developed. So the lack of distinction there is in the oneness between giver, receiver, and the gift itself. And some of you have done Sesshin, and who recently did Rahatsu, see that in our meal chants, this is codified, and it's something that we chant twice a day in the meal chant. And empty here. So the idea is that they're that giver and receiver and gift are, there's an understanding of the emptiness of all three, which is another word for interconnection of all three. So we start out with chanting the names of the Buddha, where he was born, where he was enlightened, where he died or entered, where he taught, and where he died and entered nirvana. And then it talks about realizing the emptiness of the three wheels, Dharma wheels. So Dharma wheels, setting the wheels of Dharma in motion, is a phrase found in the tradition. And so these three, the giver, the receiver, and the gift, are seen are called wheels, Dharma wheels. So empty means equality, oneness. So no difference. So when we're in Sesshin, I never could talk about this before, just recently, after practicing for many, many years doing the meal chant. But after you get over the strangeness culturally of Oryoki and the meal service, and you do it again and again, there's the possibility of seeing how that is comes alive, you know, when your friend is there in front of you, bowing to you, and then they go all the way down to the floor and they offer you the food, which the Tenzo has been, their entire practice has been to prepare that food, and then you receive that with a bow while chanting. All this is happening at once, and through that there's a way to get a sense, a felt sense for broadening out reality, you know, getting a broader sense of the reality of what Dana means. So that's what I think is the perfection of Dana, considered the perfection. Or you could say refining, refinement. If you have trouble with the word perfection, or you have struggle with perfectionism, then you might like that word better. Yeah, there's a book. It's the name of that book called Enlightenment in the Zen Kitchen, Refining Your Life. That's a book about Tenzo practice. And goes into some detail about that. So, experiencing the reality of the emptiness of the three Dharma wheels of giver, receiver, and gift enables me to take one more step on this path of practice of the paramitas, which Thich Nhat Hanh calls crossing over, as in crossing over to the other side. So giving produces joy in us, but it's not the goal so much. Although Thich Nhat Hanh also says that when we create joy through giving or other means, that it's a wholesome dharma. It's a wholesome seed that's in our storehouse consciousness that we feed through experiencing it again and again. And by experiencing wholesome seeds again and again, we sort of plow the ground in a way that has an inhibiting effect on the less wholesome seeds like anger, resentment, criticism, etc. So it has the ability to build and maintain the reserves in us that when we're challenged can hold us in good stead. People who work in hospice and volunteer in crisis nurseries or senior care homes, they're often have told me, and I've experienced it myself, that they're a little embarrassed when people praise them lavishly for doing that hard work, because they feel like they're getting so much from it themselves, that there's a bit of selfishness in their giving, in their volunteering, which I think is completely normal. We have to start from there. So another example of the perfection of giving, the giving is offering the presence that we're cultivating on the cushion to people in our lives, you know. So instead of looking at the phone and going, yeah, uh-huh, yeah, I heard you, you know, that we're fully present. And it's hard because we can't always do it. We're rushed. We're being rushed a lot. But just having the attention to do that, try to do that once a day with someone, you know, to be being fully present so they feel seen and heard. It's important. I make that a practice, and I don't always do it, but it is an important practice that I do regularly. So noticing those opportunities on a daily basis, you know, rather than numbing out. Or if you numb out, then notice you're numbing out. Come back and look for the opportunities to do that, to offer that to another person. And I think at this time of year, there's a lot of people that are depressed. My daughter works in an emergency room as a psychiatric social worker, and she said the other day on the solstice, I think it was, there were 13 people that came in suicidal. It was a long day for her. And she's a Buddhist, but she does chanting rather than, she does some sitting, but more chanting. And she was planning to go home and cuddle with her dogs in front of a fire to recharge her batteries so she could continue. So we need to recharge our batteries, and sitting is our way, is a primary way in Zen to do that. Because not only are we just settling into the breath and relaxing the body in an upright posture, but we're also, we can imagine, use our imagination in our practice to empathize with people's lives that are harder than ours. Like, what is it like to be homeless? What is it like to be living in a tent in Minneapolis? You know, so it helps us to do that, to imagine. And also practicing metta, loving kindness, and compassion formally also fills us, you know, with what it takes to recharge. All right. Talked about that already. Talked about that. Oh, I wanted to mention that the practices that are found in the formal liturgy for retreat practice here at Zen Center were inspired by Dogen, but were refined by Keizan Jokin. And in our liturgy, that our names of the ancestors that we chant on Saturdays, Keizan is one that you'll see the Doshi bow down for, along with Dogen and Lhasu Bandhu, Ashwagosha, etc. He spent a lot of his life standardizing and refining these ritual aids to awakening. That's what they are. It's not just liturgy, like something that's dead. It's alive, and it's an aid to waking up within the practice. So I mentioned earlier that the early Buddhists conceived of dana basically relationally, and how you behave with other human beings. But it was largely in the context of their renunciate lifestyle. So their job was to keep all the rules, the monastic rules, and to maintain a purity of body and speech and mind, and to keep a sacred or pure, if you will, practice place. That was their sole responsibility, and perhaps maybe to do some work for the village that they were in. So today, it's a little bit different. The opportunity to go beyond this early idea of the perfection of a generosity, it's a very different setting now. So it's expanding for all Buddhists or Dharma practitioners to include participating in the political realm, the social and political realm. You know, toward more equitable policies that relieve suffering for people at large in our society. And speaking of the children, you know, on behalf of, you know, keeping the social, you know, contract in place for caring for people, immigration, preserving the environment, and the children are watching us. They understand that their future is perilous, and they understand that it's best if everyone tries to make an effort, you know, to give something to the goal of creating a more equitable, humane, kind, and safe world, you know, safe environmentally. So we don't have as much time as we did in the 70s and the 80s to sit around on our cushions because there is this feeling that we need to take it off the cushion and do some things, and that we are very well positioned to do that because of our practice, because of the support of Sangha, friends on the path, and because of this practice that helps us to stand up in a place with courage and with keeping in mind kind speech, with everything that involves timing, tone, intention. So that's one thing. Whatever we do, whether it's demonstrating or whether it's contacting politicians or working in larger groups to support larger groups that are addressing some of these larger problems, we know we have to do it with some patience and some kindness and compassion. So one other way is giving encouragement. We're sharing courage in this way of making our effort to the society outside of our little world, our little worlds that we exist in. So that's a refinement or a perfection of giving, is giving courage to people in who despair. To ourselves when we despair at the state of the world, and to others when they despair. It's a very common thing these days to feel off and on a sense of despair over how things are going. So demonstrating a way to live beyond fear, even when we see that things seem to appear to be falling apart and crumbling all around us, it's imperative for us. So communicating courage and kindness to each other and strangers, people we don't know, is the perfection of giving, Dana Paramita. And energy or virya, cultivating that can help us with it. Sometimes we'll need to take a break and recharge, but at the very least we can offer that antidote to despair. So I'm going to end today with a poem that you've heard before. I know you've heard it before, but it's a gift from Mary Oliver. So I'm going to share this gift with you once more. It's called Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. So that's a nice gift from Mary Oliver. So I'll just end with my intention that I'll share with you that I intend to continue to relate to people in a way where they feel seen, where they feel heard, in hopes to reduce the loneliness that there's so much of in these modern times. And as an extension of non-fear, and to connect with my courage through my practice. So that's my intention, and I hope now in the discussion you might share yours. So thanks for listening. So does anyone have an intention to share, or just a comment or question? Or
I love that story about Katagiri giving his son the tree. And the first time I heard it was from Kaz's mother, Tamoy. And I asked her, well, did he like it? And her eyes got real big and she said, no! And you know, gifts like that, as parents, sometimes we give gifts that we know they're not going to like. And I don't know, maybe, you know, it's a little risky because we know that it may make him never do another retreat ever. But we still are giving the best thing that we can think of. And so Donna is really, it's really tricky.
Mm-hmm.
It's the intention is always good, and the love behind it is good. And whether or not it has the outcome that we hope doesn't matter at all. You know, it's sort of beyond anything that we need to be worrying about. You know? It's such a wonderful, simple, little funny story, but it's got a lot of tenderness to it. I'd love to hear what Kaz has to say now. This is what, 50 cents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who knows? Maybe it's the gift that keeps on giving.
Anyway, thanks for telling us.
Forgive my hearing.
Oh.
Earlier when you said, I think you said your daughter, who's in more of a chanting path, works mm-hmm. where that 13 people came in over the solstice?
Oh, she works in the emergency room of a hospital in Seattle.
This is your daughter?
Yeah.
And she's more of a Rinzai?
No, she's a Nichiren Shoshu. They chant Namu Rengyekyo. They do some sitting, but mostly.
She's a nurse in Seattle?
She's a social worker in Seattle. Psychiatric, yeah. Mm-hmm. Deb?
So, I know that a lot of us people have different levels of generosity just by nature, and I sometimes read an obituary and I go, oh my gosh, that person took in like 100 foster kids over their lifetime. And it's like, yeah. It's unbelievable how generous some people are with their lives. And then I also know for myself and for some others that even little acts of kindness are meaningful, and that boundary between your act of generosity and that servitude maybe a little closer and easier to kind of get over into that, you know, I'm feeling like a martyr, I'm feeling like so it's just that comment or question, you know, how to build that kind of natural generosity so it's not more servitude and more just a part of our own nature.
Yeah, I think that's the practice, that's the path we're on, is just to work with that. You know, we can learn from this extreme story about the Buddha, or I agree, I have the same reaction when I read about a woman who had hundreds of foster children, and I try to put myself into her heart mind, and I can't. I just can't, because I can't imagine doing that myself. But I think it's learning. We learn to discriminate in a way. We also learn from our failures. You know, sometimes we give the gift to people of allowing them to fail, to have their own failures and learn from that. You know, our children or ourselves, our friends. You know, and gosh, business people talk about how important failure is to them, has been to them. What they learned, how they could never have ended up being as successful as they were without their failures, you know. And so I think it's just all part of the composting process of the path. It's seeing where we are and what we're capable of and having a clear intention, you know. That's refining our lives, refining Donna as we go along. Does that help? Yeah, that's a good point. Jeffrey?
Thank you for the story about Katakuri and his gift to his son. I think it's a problem to say that the love and the intention are the important thing in our acts. We also have to take responsibility for the consequences.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this is what you were saying when you were talking about learning from one's failures.
Mm-hmm.
This manifests itself in all kinds of ways. Relationships between men and women, mm-hmm. relationships between white people and people of color.
Yeah.
I didn't intend to hurt you,
mm-hmm.
but my act did hurt. So mm-hmm. how can I learn from this?
Right, exactly. That's our path. And being aware that sometimes our intentions, although they're good, and we have good intentions, they have sometimes the opposite result. The result of our actions based on our good intentions is not always so good. There's a lot of things that we don't know that are missing from our understanding, and we can only find out when we realize that we've goofed up. Yeah, and then, yeah, take responsibility. I agree. And so I think, you know, that, you know, what we're going to be doing here, that Ben is spearheading, is looking at, for instance, what it means to be white and our whiteness and the whiteness in our sangha, and that's what we need to do, you know. That's, at least I feel I need to do that. That's my responsibility in this life, is to look deeply into that. Another plug I'm going to make to you all for the new schedule coming up in January is, you know, those of you who've been here for a long time and really just like the one Sunday service, this is a great opportunity to practice generosity. Thinking of this change with two services every Sunday as a way of giving Donna, opening up the intention of it, I think, and Ted, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is to offer the opportunity for people, for more people to come into a space that's peaceful and quiet and to hear some Dharma, get a little teaching and guidance for life, daily life, that's the intention. It may feel like it's a little too sparsely populated at first, and we might be tempted to think, well, this isn't working after only a couple weeks, but I think that we can extend the generosity of spirit of just seeing how it goes and remembering the intention, because I think we can all decide over time, you know, whether it's an experiment that's been a good one or not. So that's my little commercial plug.